You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 265, Exodus 4, 18-31. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you doing this week?
Pretty good. It is warmer here, and the newest pug just got neutered this week.
Oh, my gosh. That makes me cringe. Talked about getting my dog neutered, too, but I can't bring myself to do that, Mike.
Yeah, well, we didn't have any trouble doing that.
You have no problem with that, huh?
We have no problem with it.
I've been around cattle, you know, when we brand them and I see what happens, and it I think it scarred me as a kid watching this. And
yeah, well, it may have.
I have permanent trauma because of this. And
He's fine. Yeah. He's fine. He's back. First, we brought him home. He was a little doped up, so that was kind of funny. Uh-huh. You know, some cheap entertainment there. But yeah, he's just fine.
Well, that's good.
He's himself.
Yeah. Well, not really, but
he's still got as much energy, so he's okay.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah. That's good.
So that's what's new. You asked what's new. Don't ask the question unless I'm not, you want
that's
the answer.
Last time I asked that question. I need to come up with some different opening. I don't know, something, but man. Well, we got something new that we can announce briefly, not all the details, but our Naked Bible Conference is fast approaching, and we finally have a date and a place again, and it's going to be October 12th at the same place we had it last year at the Omni Park West Hotel in Dallas, Texas. We're bringing it back to Dallas. On October 12th, I get lots of emails, Mike, about when the next one is coming, And so we at least wanted to get that information out so people could start preparing. And then as we get the speakers finalized and things like that, I'll update the website. And you know, of course, we'll let everybody know that. But we just wanted to let people at least know the date.
Yeah, October 12th, the same place as we had it last year in Dallas.
Yeah, that place was good.
It was.
Mike, you can't believe it, but over 34 states were represented at their first annual conference, which is crazy.
Dallas. Yeah. And it's important to keep it in the middle of the country, you know, somewhere. So
absolutely. If I can ever get Mike not afraid of water, maybe we can go to Hawaii.
No? Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
No, it'd be nice to have it in Hawaii. Caribbean.
Yeah, right at the foot of a volcano. Let's do that. Yeah.
Something tropical. That'd be fun. Maybe we'll see. All right. Well, baseball's around the corner, so you got to be happy about that.
Oh yeah, I'm counting the days, man.
Yeah, counting the days. Any quick thoughts about Harper and Philly and all that stuff here for?
I think he's a good fit. Yeah, I think he's a good fit. So I didn't grow up a Philly fan, even though I'm from Pennsylvania. I was a Pirates fan back in the day, and I still like them. I still like the Cubs. You know, I'm not into these rivalries. I mean, I'm a Red Sox fan, really, for the most part. But, you know, when you're in fantasy, you kind of root for guys, you know, and you root for teams too. So I think he's a good fit.
Is Drina a Philly fan?
Not too much. She doesn't follow baseball as much, but, you know, she's okay with the Phillies, but her real love, she says, is the Yankees. So yes, my wife is a Yankees fan. And I'm a Red Sox.
I'm going to stop asking questions. This podcast is starting off on the wrong foot here.
You know,
I'm going
to. Every year we used to have to go up, you know, to Seattle.
I'm so sorry.
Or down to Seattle, and pay homage to Derek Jeter. But gone for a few years now, so we haven't had to do that.
Yankees, Red Sox in the same house. That must have been brutal.
I was happy last year.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But the 20, 30 years before that.
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't talk about that.
Yeah. I hear you. But what we can talk about is, hey, we're still in Exodus.
Yeah. And this kind of goes right into the, into my pug getting neutered. You know, we're kind of in that territory with the bridegroom blood passage, you know.
A lot of people are going to be interested about this. Lots of, interpretations of this particular issue.
Yeah, we'll have to put something in the summary that'll really help with keyword searching. You know, just get a whole new audience, maybe. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, we're in Exodus 4, 18 through 31, and the whole thing isn't about, the bridegroom of blood incident. That's really only three verses in this section, verses 24 through 26. And we've already, based on, the last episode, we drifted over into this second half of chapter 4. So we've already touched on a few things in this section of verses 18 through 31. But our focus is going to be those specific verses, 24, 25, 26, today. But just, again, so that we're familiar with where we're at, I'm going to read the whole thing, the whole section. So starting in verse 18, we read, Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, now this is right after the burning bush story, or at least ostensibly. So Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go back to my brothers in Egypt to see whether they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. And the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons and had them ride on a donkey and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the staff of God in his hand. And the Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you do before Pharaoh all the miracles that I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. And I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. Verse 24, this is, again, these next few verses are going to be our focus. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone. It was then that she said, a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. Back to verse 27. Then the Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness to meet Moses. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him to speak and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and gathered all the elders of the people of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and did the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. That's the end of the section and the end of the chapter. Now, you can already tell that this is kind of a chronological mess. You know, you get the burning bush incident. And on the tail end of that, when Moses is basically saying, you know, please find someone else to do this, and God gets angry at him, like we talked about last time. You know, we've had a series of objections, and then Moses, you know, if God gives him answers to all the objections, then Moses just flatly said, well, I don't want to go. God gets angry, and then God makes a concession to Moses, and we talked about the concession last time. This is where we get the Aaronic priesthood sort of launched. You know, God brings Aaron into the picture as a concession to Moses, and God actually says, back in verse 14, is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he's coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Well, between that statement of, hey, Aaron's on his way, he's coming out to meet you, we get Moses going back to Jethro, okay, to ask him about going. Why didn't he wait for Aaron? You know, we talked about this last time. And then you get God speaking again to Moses in Midian, at apparently Jethro's place, because it follows his return to Jethro, where Jethro lives. And then you got all that going on. Then Moses takes off, and then we get the bridegroom of blood incident where God wants to kill Moses, you know, apparently. And then after that, then we're back to Aaron. Then God says in verse 27, Lord said to Aaron, go to the wilderness and meet Moses. Well, I thought he already told Aaron to do that. You know, and then they actually meet up, and then they wind up in Egypt. So chronologically, this is just a mess. And that's part of the problem. And, you know, even if we took out verses 24 through 26, did we just, you know, cut them out? You know, we did a Thomas Jefferson or something. you still have a chronological problem because, hey, I thought back in verse 14, God had already tapped Aaron on the shoulder. And here in verse 27, he's doing it again. Well, what in the world's going on here? So we've got a chronological problem, to say the least. We've got the intrusion of this really bizarre episode, the Bridegroom of Blood. And so the issue is, what in the world, you know, do we do with this stuff? Now, I would suggest, again, there are, broadly speaking, two ways to read verses 18 through 31. And I alluded to the first of these in the last episode. You honestly, you got to use your imagination here and sort of admit that you have to infer things, or things might be implied rather than stated. Okay, but let's just jump into it, because either way, there's a lot to deal with here. So there's two ways to sort of read this section. First one is you could say, well, it's implied in the previous section, okay, the burning bush incident, the tail end of that, that Aaron is literally on his way, having been tapped or prompted by God to meet his brother Moses. You know, that little phrase, he is coming out to meet you, again in verse 14. But we never read, of course, that they actually meet. Again, when we talked about this the last episode, instead, we get the distinct impression from verses 18 and following that Moses just left after God makes the concession. Hey, we'll bring Aaron into the picture here to help you out. Moses just takes off, regardless of the fact that God said, hey, he's on his way. He's coming out to meet you. Well, apparently they'd ever meet. Moses leaves. He goes back to Jethro's place. Now, we know that Jethro's place where he lived was not at the mountain of God because of Exodus 3:1, which we spent, 4 weeks on? Okay, now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. So Jethro doesn't live at the mountain. It's not like the movie The Ten Commandments where, you know, the mountain's a few hundred yards away or something. Okay, that's not the impression you get. So Moses goes back to Jethro's place. But then in verse 27, we see that Aaron meets Moses at the mountain of God. Apparently, again, we're just suggesting one way to look at this. Apparently, Moses went back to Sinai after returning to Jethro. But that raises two questions. Was it okay for Moses to leave Sinai at the end of the burning bush episode and go back to Jethro and then return to Sinai? We aren't told. We aren't told if God was good with that or not. But we could presume that it was okay because Aaron, for all we know, is back in Egypt. I mean, he's still back in Egypt. It would take a while for Aaron to get to Sinai. The second question it raises is, did God anticipate Moses' rebellion and call Aaron earlier? So Aaron is basically right around the corner ready to meet Moses, and then Moses takes off. We aren't told that either. And I'll just throw in a third question here. Did Moses return to Sinai with his tail between his legs in fear? You know, like he leaves when he's not supposed to. And he talks to Jethro, and God taps him on, God meets him again. You know, God speaks to him again, okay? And then Moses, okay, I got to go back to Sinai. I'm in trouble. You know, like, does he go back fearfully? Is that how we're supposed to read this? If so, was the threat of verses 24 through 26 when God's ready to kill him, is that directly related to Moses leaving, or is that related to something else? So we've got a number of questions here before we even get to the bizarre three verses that we're going to focus on, because we have a non-chronological thing going on in Exodus 4 that's really related, again, to, you know, the burning bush episode. You know, stuff that happens earlier, you know, earlier in chapter 3 and chapter 4, but mostly chapter 4, because that's where you get the conversation between God and Moses, where Moses just basically says, I don't want to go, and then God makes the concession with Aaron. Now, there's another way to read this, okay? Here's the second way to sort of approach it. The other way to read this is that verses 24 through 26 are simply an intrusion. They're a literary intrusion. They have nothing to do with the chronology. It's placed there because the author isn't concerned with the chronology of things, but with telegraphing some other point. Yeah, that's possible. We're going to encounter other places in Exodus that are clearly not chronological, even though they you know, we tend to think that as we're reading through a book, everything that's happening is chronological. But there are going to be some places where it's absolutely clear. For instance, we're gonna hit one place where they put Aaron's rod before the testimony, and the testimony is a term that's related to the Ark of the Covenant. But that's in a chapter before the Ark of the Covenant's even created. It's not even made yet. So it's very obviously not chronological. So we're going to hit stuff like that in Exodus. So this is a possibility that verses 24 to 26 are just sort of dropped in there for some other reason other than the chronology. And in so doing, it kind of messes up the chronology for us. But there, let's be honest, even without those verses, there's stuff that messes up the chronology. Now, if this is the case, that verses 24 through 26 are just sort of dropped in there, that would mean that the meeting of verses 27 through 31 could actually follow verse 17. In other words, God sent Aaron to meet Moses at Sinai, suggesting Moses stayed there a while before going back to Jethro's place. We can imagine that happening. We can imagine verses 27 through 31 happening at Sinai before Moses goes back to Jethro in verse 18. If the sections of the chapter are loosed from being a strict chronology, then we can move them around. We can play with them a little bit. Again, that might be a way to approach this. But that creates a problem too. If this is the case, when does Moses actually meet Jethro to ask for permission, verse 18, to go to Egypt as the Lord commanded? And why would God have to speak to Moses again in Midian, reiterating the conversation about going to Egypt that had taken place at Sinai? In other words, if we move the meeting with Aaron, verses 27 to 31, up to happen right after the burning bush, then that should have been a settled matter. And then you know, yeah, maybe that looks good preceding verse 18, but when you get into verse 18, the conversation that happens there, just that messes with our mind too. That just doesn't seem to work either. You know, again, we just got a lot of problems here. There's a lot that, again, you have to sort of imagine and infer. And I'm going to do that as we proceed. I'm going to basically say how I would approach this. But on the surface, this is not a simple section. You might think it's a simple section. You might think the only thing that really needs any thought here are verses 24 through 26, the bridegroom of blood weirdness. But that's not the case. There's a lot of things going on here that just don't, on the surface, make sense. You know, when you start looking at it and, you know, if you made a play of this, if you were going to reenact it, how in the world would you do it? You'd run into all sorts of problems. So, I mean, what do we do with this? Now, I'll throw one more in. When you get to verse 20, that has Moses taking his sons, plural, and Zipporah when he starts on the trip to Egypt. But Exodus 18, verse 2 notes that at some point Moses had sent Zipporah back home to Midian. I'll just read you Exodus 18, 2. Now, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, had taken Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her home. Again, when did he send her home? Does that have any relationship to verse 24, which is the beginning of the bridegroom of blood thing incident? Would that suggest that the bridegroom of blood incident occurs on the way to Egypt? And then on the way, Zipporah and at least one son are in the scene, but then, you know, maybe they get sent back later. Do they ever actually get to Egypt? Again, we don't know. How in the world, you know, are we going to explain all that, you know, then throw in the meeting with Aaron? I mean, again, I'm trying to convey the sense that there's a lot that's confusing here. The chronology of events is really convoluted and problematic. It's hard to know if the parts of chapter 4 intend to give us any chronology or not. Again, it's another, you know, critical scholars look at this kind of stuff and say, well, look, the reason this is a mess is because you have different sources. You have different source accounts that were stitched together by an editor. You know, the whole JEDB thing, you know, it's editing on steroids, okay? So, again, it's hard to know, you know, how these parts of chapter 4 relate to each other. It's also impossible to know why Zipporah was sent back and precisely when. The text isn't really clear on any of those details. We have to imagine events or the purpose of the placement of verses 24 through 26 and go from there. Now, here's what I would propose. And I'm admitting up front that it springs from my imagination. I'm trying to take the data and just sort of again, be like a movie director or something. If this was a play, or we're going to reenact this, how would we account for all of the elements in something of a coherent fashion? If we were visually seeing what's going on here, I tend to think Moses takes off from Sinai, you know, right after the burning bush incident. And again, I mentioned that in the last episode. Whether God was happy with that or not, we can't necessarily know. Okay, and I could see it going either way. I tend to think Moses takes off from Sinai. He could have waited, but he doesn't. He goes to Jethro's place, which is not Sinai. And he starts to have second thoughts, which would be entirely consistent with Moses' character. Okay. And so that's why God speaks to him again. I mean, God actually speaks to him again. Verse 19, the Lord said to Moses in Midian, they're in Midian, he's in Midian, go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead. So Moses might have been having second thought, like, man, if I go back to Egypt, they're going to kill me. See, that wasn't mentioned earlier. So he may be having second thoughts, and then God has to come with him and, look, don't worry about it, I'll handle it. Those guys are dead, get off your butt and go to Egypt, all right? So God speaks to him again while he's in Midian, and then Moses decides to tell Jethro he has to go to Egypt. And he does. Then he starts on the journey with Zipporah and the boys. The boys' names, of course, are Gershom and Eliezer. Their names are given later in Exodus 18, verses 2 through 4. On the way to Egypt, now here's a key element, and again, it's just springing from my imagination. I think this could have happened. On the way to Egypt, he passes by or near Sinai. Now, this is possible if Sinai is to the west of Midian, where Exodus 3:1 says it is. In other words, Moses has to journey around the north tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. He's got to go a little bit north and west, or maybe directly west, because we don't know where Jethro lived in Midian. We don't know what part of Midian. But in any way, Sinai, if it's west of Midian, would be on the way to going back to Egypt. So on the way to Egypt, Moses passes by, he stops at Sinai. Maybe he says, hey, we're going to Egypt, but first I have to meet Aaron at Sinai. And this is when the meeting, the episode of verses 27 through 31 occurs. God having called Aaron, tapped Aaron, weeks, months, we don't know, ago, because Aaron's in Egypt, and he's got to make the trip too, the other direction. So it's at this point that Moses and Aaron meet, and they have the conversation they have in verses 27 through 31, and then together they head to Egypt. Now, God may not be happy. We could say that maybe, you know, God thinks Moses should have stayed and waited for Aaron to, you know, despite telling him this, Aaron was the solution, Moses loses heart, or the thought of the guys in Egypt trying to kill him surface in his mind. He has second thoughts. God has to speak to him again. All that's still up in the air, but at least we have a way to make sense of where Moses is and where he goes, his movements. He finally gets to Aaron at Sinai, okay, at the mountain of God. Because you look at verse 27, the Lord said to Aaron, go to the wilderness and meet Moses. So he went and met him at the mountain of God. So they finally connect at Sinai, and then they go to Egypt. So that's how I would sort of reconstruct in my mind what's going on here to create a chronology out of this mess. To have it make sense, you have to infer some things. And I think that's legitimate. I mean, that you got to do that in a lot of places, especially in narrative in the Old Testament. There's nothing that I just said that can't work with the text. I can't say that all of that is spelled out in the text, because it's not. If it was, we wouldn't even be having the discussion. But nothing I just gave you there violates any point of the text. And so this is what we're trying to do, just trying to make sense out of it. So now a related question. Does the Bridegroom of Blood episode happen before or after they meet Aaron at Sinai? And if this is something of an intrusion and we're not told at all, I mean, it has some connection to the itinerary, because verse 24 says, at a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought him to put him to death. Okay. So this incident happens either before they meet up with Aaron or after? What is the way? Is it the way to Sinai that I've imagined, or the way to Egypt? Again, we're not told. So where does the Bridegroom of Blood episode happen? I would say it happens before they meet Aaron at Sinai. And I'm just going to say that my reasons for thinking that will become evident as we proceed here. I'm just going to telegraph it up front, so it's lurking, in the back of your mind here. I think that the Bridegroom of Blood episode happens before they meet up with Aaron at Sinai, and then from Sinai they go to Egypt. The only thing that might throw this off is verse 27's wording: "The Lord said to Moses." Now Moses should have already known what the Lord said about going to meet Aaron. He should have already known that. I mean, God has mentioned it before, but maybe the point is that, hey, Moses, God speaking to Moses, hey, we're good now. Okay, I'm not angry. I'm not going to kill you. Zipporah has taken care of the problem that was prompting me to think about killing you. So keep going to Sinai, hook up with Aaron, and then get to Egypt. Again, I still have to infer that. In other words, God says, we're good now and the plan is still on. Now, having said all that, I really don't think that the Bridegroom of Blood incident, verses 24 through 26, is actually about Moses' continued second-guessing or faint-heartedness. I think it's about another problem with Moses. And I think that for a simple reason. Whatever the problem is, it's taken care of by a circumcision. That would really have nothing to do with Moses leaving Sinai or needing a pep talk from God. A circumcision doesn't fix those things. There's something going on in verses 24 through 26 that is an altogether different problem involving Moses, and that problem is taken care of by Zipporah's quick action in circumcising, performing the circumcision. Now, let's look at verses 24 through 26 for the rest of our episode. Zero in on the Bridegroom of Blood stuff. I'm going to read the verses again. "At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin." Okay. "Cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, 'Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me.' So he let him alone. It was then that she said, 'A bridegroom of blood,' because of the circumcision." Now, I have, back in 2011, so this is 7 years ago, I had blogged about this. I had mentioned that in the last time. What I'm going to give you here, again, I think is just worded better than what was back on the blog. So I've actually swapped some of this discussion in. I more or less wanted to write this out for the sake of the blog, because there were some things in there that I thought were just not clear, not sufficiently clear. So I've tried to dress that up a little bit. So I'm telling you that here on the podcast. But, what we're going to hear now, again, is essentially, you could have read it before already, on the blog. But I think the wording is better here. I just took a little more time to, for the sake of clarity, to try to dress things up. The issues are, again, as we look at verses 24 through 26, what are the things we need to think about? Well, there's what in the world is up with placing the foreskin at Moses' feet. It's kind of odd that God would want to kill Moses, especially on the heels of calling him and then making a concession for him with the Aaronic priesthood, and then reminding him that you need to go to Egypt while he's in Midian. Again, it would have to be something that's pretty significant, for Moses, as the person God wants to lead his people, for God to just get this angry and consider killing him. The other issue is that, as we're going to see, there are certain ambiguities in these three verses, in the text, specifically what certain verbs refer to and who the actors are precisely in the scene. Because I can tell you right now, the ESV has made, and every translation does this, this isn't a slap on the ESV. The ESV translator has inserted names and nouns in places in verses 24 through 26, where in the Hebrew text there are only pronouns, he and his and him. Okay, the translator has done that to try to make the content of these verses comprehensible. But we need to talk about that, because knowing that certain things are ambiguous in the Hebrew text, like what does the pronoun refer to when it says his or him? Is it Moses' son or Moses? Again, which they're both masculine. So which one does the masculine pronoun refer to? You have to make an educated or an interpretive guess. You have to land somewhere in interpretation, and the translation, of course, is going to land somewhere to try to steer us through. But you know, sometimes the choices that translators make are good. Sometimes they're not so good. Sometimes they help. Sometimes they muddy the waters even more. But we need to think about all of these things. So let's try to approach the stuff we need to think about. Really, I guess, two trajectories here. So first, who is it that the Lord wanted to kill? Now you would think, and we've sort of presumed here in the sake of our discussion, you'd think that that's Moses. And most readers would assume it is Moses, since he's mentioned in the preceding verses. But verse 24 actually doesn't name him. You know, we see here, at a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. We don't get the Lord met Moses. We get the Lord met him. And you say, well, why is that an issue? Well, Moses is traveling with two boys, his two sons. Could it be that Moses or God wanted to put one of them to death? Would that make more sense? Because he just called Moses. Why does he want to kill him off now? I mean, you actually have, you know, this discussion going on. And since it's one of the boys' foreskins that is removed through circumcision, in other words, since the solution of the episode is the circumcision of one of the boys, maybe it's one of the boys that God wants to kill because he's uncircumcised. Okay? So, you know, who exactly are we talking about? Who's under threat? The other, again, trajectory is, what does it mean for Zipporah to touch Moses' feet with the foreskin? Now, there are two other factors, again, that are going to be part of this discussion as we try to take things in order. Again, Zipporah knows what to do. She's familiar with circumcision, obviously. She knows that it should be done, and she knows how to do it. She knows how it's done. So that is going to become a factor in interpretation as well. So we've got ambiguities in there. We've got some things we can assume about Zipporah, who is a Midianite woman. Again, and think of the Kenites. The Kenites should be familiar with the worship of Yahweh. And part of the worship of Yahweh, whether they're the, you know, the quote unquote, you know, forgotten or lesser line, the non-elect line from Abraham, they still know about circumcision. Okay, so there's something going on there. Zipporah knows it's important. She knows what to do. She knows how to solve the problem. She knows what the problem is, and she takes care of business. And the way she takes care of business is circumcising her son. So we've got that much. Is the son the one under the threat? What about this touching the feet thing? Again, that's what we've, you know, as we proceed, those are the things, the questions we need to answer. So let's take things in order. With whom was God angry and why? Now, I would say it seems best to conclude that God is angry with Moses and not his son, Gershom. Since Moses is the major character in the wider context, and Gershom is known only from Exodus 2:22 at this point, he has nothing to do with the story. So despite the fact that it's the circumcision of the child that fixes the problem, or is it? Okay, or is it? Is it just, is God's anger pacified just by circumcising the boy, or is more needed? Yeah, we'll get back to that point. But if there's more needed, then it's not, you know, we can't necessarily conclude that just because the boy is circumcised that he's the problem. So I think that Moses is the one under threat here. That just makes more sense. Scholars have noted that Moses is the center of Yahweh's attention everywhere else in the story, even in the digressions about Aaron. You know, it's still really about Moses and how to deal with his resistance, his unbelief, his uncertainty, you know, his, you know, really, in some, I think you could call it rebellion in some sense as well. So that much seems clear. I mean, it's a better option. But of course, that the question of why God is angry with him is still on the table. So I would say the the answer to that question has to be inferred from two considerations. One, the Israelites born in Egypt had been circumcised. Okay, although this might still be a problem. They were circumcised, you know, according to what God had passed on or told Abraham to do. We know from Joshua 5, verses 2 through 9. I'm just going to read you that section because it's going to become relevant here. We read, again, this is Joshua. This is about, you know, they're getting ready to go into the promised land. So it's much later. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. A second? How can you be circumcised a second time? That's interesting, isn't it? So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeat Ha'aralot. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Okay, so you've got kids, you know, growing up, and apparently you could say, well, okay, they weren't circumcised yet. Why the second time? Verse 5, though all the people who came out of Egypt, okay, so verse 4 is about the kids that were born during the wilderness wanderings and all that, they need to be circumcised, okay, the men. But verse 5 harkens back to the previous generation. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised. So verse 5, the first part of it says, the people who came out, you know, had come out of Egypt, they had been circumcised. So they're doing circumcision in Egypt, okay, or, you know, they, before this point. It's the ones afterwards that have not. But then what in the world is this second time thing going on? It's just really odd. Verse 7, so it was their children whom he raised up in their place that Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. So verse 8, they circumcised the whole nation. When that was finished, they remained in their places in the camp till they were healed. And then, of course, you know, the conquest is going to start. So, you know, what's up with this? How does it inform the issue with Moses? Why is God angry at him? And again, this has to be inferred from two considerations. The Israelites born in Egypt had been circumcised, apparently according to, you know, the covenant with Abraham. That's why they were doing it. And two, we have to consider the circumstances of Moses' birth and childhood again. Now, let's just jump in. With respect to the first of these items, it may be that the Israelites in Egypt practiced Egyptian circumcision. Okay, Israelites are in Egypt. What we just read in Joshua says they were circumcising down in Egypt. Maybe this Joshua doing the circumcision a second time, maybe this refers to the fact that, or to the possibility that, the circumcision they were doing in Egypt was not correct. Egyptian circumcision, which by the way refers to a method, not anything religious, like circumcision wasn't being done in honor to some foreign god, okay? Egyptian circumcision refers to a method, and it's possible Moses and other Israelite men were not properly circumcised. The second time in Joshua 5:2 might be an indication of this, that, yep, they were, but we got to do it again because it wasn't done right. Having fled from Egypt, God may have expected Moses to correct this before returning to Egypt. You know, because Moses is the representative now of Israel. He is the leader of Israel, whether he wants to be or not, he is. I mean, Aaron's going to again take up the slack, obviously. But Moses is the key figure here, and God might be angry with him because he has been circumcised incorrectly and never took care of the problem. Now, that's an argument from silence, but any other explanation is as well. You know, so this is what we're dealing with here. Let me just rabbit trail a little bit about the circumcision thing in Egypt. Archaeologists and Egyptologists know that circumcision was practiced in Egypt by the Egyptians. However, Egyptian circumcision did not remove the foreskin. That's how it's possible you could be circumcised again, all right, if it wasn't done properly. Egyptian circumcision did not remove the foreskin. Rather, the foreskin was just split. It was left there, but it was split. For this reason, any Israelite born in Egypt who happened to be circumcised in this way had not been circumcised in a manner acceptable to God's covenant. Those who take this trajectory as an explanation for God's anger would suggest that Egyptian circumcision is what's hinted at in Joshua 5:2, again about the second time, but also Joshua 5:9, which reads, "And the Lord said to Joshua, 'Today I have rolled away the reproach from Egypt from you.'" Yeah, the reproach from Egypt might be their bondage and slavery, because they're going to go into the land now and have their own land. I get that. But there are some who say that the issue with circumcising them the second time is correcting this Egyptian method. And maybe that is the reproach of Egypt. We're fixing that problem now by having everybody, both the men who came out of Egypt that are still around, and then the second generation that was born on the way in the wilderness wanderings, they're both circumcised properly now, both groups. So maybe that's what the reproach of Egypt refers to. Again, it's possible. So again, given this set of circumstances, the ceremony in Joshua 5 would be a second circumcision for some and a first second circumcision for the males born in the wilderness wanderings. And Joshua 5:2 is really what this view hangs on, this reference to the second time. So that's, again, that's one way to look at this. Since other Israelite males were circumcised prior to the conquest, again, prior to Joshua, 5:2-9 at Gilgal, and some a second time, it is reasonable to assume, again, since they had to do this, since they had to fix this, first generation and second generation, it's reasonable to assume that Moses had never been circumcised, or that he was circumcised according to Egyptian custom. The narrative of Moses' birth and childhood never states that his parents, like his Israelite parents, had him circumcised. Had the boy been marked by Hebrew circumcision, maybe his life would have been in danger in Pharaoh's household. Who knows? We can only speculate whether Pharaoh's daughter had him circumcised in the Egyptian manner after he entered her household. In either scenario, whether Pharaoh's daughter had this done according to the Egyptian custom, or whether his Israelite parents just didn't do it, again, thinking that, well, when the baby's discovered, if they see it's an Israelite male, they might kill him because that's what Pharaoh ordered. Okay, either scenario means that Moses did not bear the covenant sign, and that is why God is angry. Now, in his Exodus commentary, this is in the Word Biblical Commentary series, Durham notes this material. This is his discussion over all this. So, it's not just Mike here, okay? Durham is going to he's going to cite an article by Jack Sasson. It's S-A-S-S-O-N. So here we go. The quote is this. Sasson has pointed out convincingly that Egyptian circumcision was not only performed on adults, but was, by comparison with Hebrew circumcision, merely a partial circumcision. Indeed, he contends that circumcision may well have come to Egypt from North Syria, where it was practiced early in the 3rd millennium BC. For whatever reasons, the compiler, who set verses 24 through 26 in their present context, had apparently reached a conclusion confirmed by these facts. Perhaps he combined the abnormal circumstances by which the infant Moses had been hidden away at birth with some knowledge of the Egyptian practice and even a belief that the circumcision of infant boys was a late development in Israel's life. Quite possibly, he too was searching for some reason for Yahweh's serious encounter. Whatever the case, he clearly believed that Moses was uncircumcised and that Yahweh determined to stop him en route to Egypt for that reason. That's the end of the Durham quote. So again, this isn't Mike just sort of speculating. I mean, this is an explanation for why God is angry that other scholars, have come up with. And again, just trying to overview the basis for it. Another angle, again, with this, let's just go back to Moses' childhood here. Another angle is that it's possible Moses' mother would not have had him circumcised again because of the edict. I want to say a little bit more about that. Again, the rationale in that case would have been that, maybe an Egyptian who discovers the boy will see him uncircumcised and have mercy on him or something like that. But see, there's a problem with that. Pharaoh's daughter knew immediately that the baby was a Hebrew. So the question is, how did she know? Now, it doesn't have to be because he was circumcised. It could be something as simple as, well, why would anybody else put their kid in a basket and set him afloat in the Nile? It's got to be a Hebrew kid. In the movie, it has him with a Hebrew blanket or something. Ten Commandments movie doesn't get into all this stuff. So it doesn't have to, you know, the fact that Pharaoh's daughter recognizes this is a Hebrew boy doesn't mean that the Hebrew boy was circumcised. He may not have been. Even if he was, again, there's no sense in avoiding the circumcision, you know, you would think, because, you know, she's trusting God or whatever. I think the chances are really good. I think that, you know, if the Israelite parents of Moses had him circumcised, then there's no need for, you know, the secondary Egyptian circumcision, which again did not remove the foreskin. So I think the best bet here is, again, it's all a guess. This is all speculation. I think the best bet is that Moses arrived in Pharaoh's household uncircumcised. Pharaoh's daughter had him circumcised according to the Egyptian custom, which was a partial circumcision, and that was never corrected when Moses fled Egypt and went into Midian. And he's not thinking about Yahweh at all. He's thinking about, I got to get out of Egypt and basically stay alive and have a nice home here. But God calls him at the burning bush incident. And again, we're not told. They don't have a conversation about circumcision, but it apparently God is thinking, do the math, Moses. You're in Midian. They worship Yahweh here. I'm Yahweh. I'm calling you to go to Egypt. You know, you might want to bear the sign of the covenant people if you're leading the covenant people. But apparently that doesn't occur to Moses, or he said, oh, you know, I don't, well, that's going to hurt. You know, that's entirely consistent with Moses' character here. That's going to hurt. And I don't want to go anyway. You know, so he, you know, he goes back to Midian. He doesn't talk to Jethro right away. God has to remind him, you know, you're supposed to go to Egypt. Okay. You know, and God even, look, everybody who wanted you dead is dead now. You know, let's get the show on the road here. And Moses does. He moves. You know, they go on their way and they stop at Sinai. They meet, you know, they're going to do all that. But when he leaves Midian, and this is my view, when he leaves Midian, he's on the way to Sinai. This is before they've met Aaron. God gets angry because he has not taken care of the covenant sign of proper circumcision. And this is how I would reconstruct things here. I think this is probably the best sort of scenario that we can garner and put together, again, using some inference, using our imagination a little bit to infer some things about why God would have been angry and how the itinerary works. Now, the reason why I think this event happens before they meet Aaron is because Aaron is a priest. He's a Levite. He would know what to do. I mean, if it became clear that God's going to kill Moses unless we do the circumcision thing or whatever, you know, he would know what to do. And so Zipporah would not have to perform the circumcision of her boy. Aaron would have done that. Again, now, this is all guesswork. It's an argument from silence. But I think, again, you can put the things together by making those inferences. So again, this is my view of how things are going on, you know, what the scenario is. Now, you could ask, well, why didn't she just circumcise her husband Moses and then they, you know, wait a few weeks or whatever? You know, Moses is probably a crybaby about that. Like, he's a crybaby about everything. So, you know, it might take a week or two or whatever, or maybe Moses would use it as an excuse to delay the trip even further. And I think that's the key. I think the reason why it was sufficient for Zipporah to circumcise the child and then touch Moses' feet, and we'll get to what feet are, with the foreskin of her son, sort of a circumcision by proxy. I think that's probably what's going on, that it's a symbolic gesture or something like that to have God's anger against Moses pacified. So let's just jump into the rest of it. So I think that is what's actually going on, and I think because she does it, they're not in Aaron's presence yet. Again, I'm fully admitting that I'm just using inferences here. And again, trying to piece together things from the data that aren't specifically said, but everybody has to do that. So we're at the point of asking the question, who was circumcised and what did it mean? Now, regardless of the fact that we don't know how to precisely take all this stuff because it's never spelled out, you got a couple options here. Either Moses was properly circumcised and he neglected to have his son circumcised, in which case God could be, in theory, mad at either one of them. But if that's the case, when they circumcise the kid, why doesn't it end there? Why doesn't it stop there? Why do you have to touch Moses' quote-unquote feet to make things good with God? So again, I think the real problem is Moses. Again, that his inadequate circumcision. And it's not just the boy. And I think that they don't circumcise Moses there because that's going to delay the trip even longer. And God wants him in Egypt. I mean, the one thing you do that does come through clearly if you read chapter 4 is God wants him in Egypt, like now. You know, we're not going to put this off anymore. I've told Aaron to meet you. Let's go. Go, 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 go. Okay, get out of here. So I think that, again, is part of the rationale. Now, the Midianites, again, as you think back to the Kenite episode, as worshipers of Yahweh, they're going to know about circumcision. They're going to know about Abraham. They're going to know about the covenant. They know about the necessary tool, you know, the flint, you know, knife there to do the rite. Again, they know what's going on here. So this is how I would handle what, you know, the rest of our little weird, you know, sidebar here, verses 24 through 26. Again, concerning whether Moses or his son Gershom was circumcised, clarity can be gained in Zipporah's act of touching the foreskin to the feet of Moses. And I think Moses is the issue. Let's talk about the feet before moving on. The Hebrew word for feet, regel, can refer to feet, legs, or genitals, according to Old Testament usage. This was a euphemism. It was a word that was used, again, as sort of a nice way, you know, to refer to the genital area. You know, every language, every culture, you know, has this sort of thing. Euphemistic language for private parts or sexual acts or something like that. Okay, this is what we're dealing with. For example, in Deuteronomy 28:57, we read, her afterbirth, this is again part of law, her afterbirth that comes out from between her feet and her children whom she bears, so on and so forth. Well, the afterbirth doesn't really come out between your feet. I mean, you can, well, yeah, you know, the legs are apart. And, you know, I was there at the birth of my kid, and the afterbirth, you know, the feet were there too. Look, the whole point is that the afterbirth comes out of the genital area, okay, of a woman. Go to Ezekiel 16:25. I think it's even clearer. This is the somewhat pornographic passage that we covered back in our series on Ezekiel, where the language is really graphic. Sexual language is really graphic there. And we have this verse I'm going to just go out to this one and get it, pick up a little bit, maybe the verse before. I'll start in verse 23. So Israel is being, or Judah is being compared to a whore, okay, a prostitute, prostituting herself with other nations, other gods, committing spiritual adultery, all this kind of stuff. Adultery and sexual whoredom were used as metaphors for spiritual unfaithfulness. So we read in verse 23, after all your wickedness, woe, woe to you, declares the Lord God. You built yourself a vaulted chamber, built yourself a bedroom there, you know, set up a bed, and made yourself a lofty place in every square. You know, you're looking for clients at every street corner. At the head of every street, you built your lofty place and made your beauty an abomination, offering yourself to any passerby and multiplying your whoredom, or your whoring. Now, ESV's offering yourself is literally in the Hebrew, spreading your regel, spreading your feet. Again, it's exposing your genitals, spreading your legs. Okay, I mean that we get the idea. You're not, you know, the woman in Ezekiel 16 who does this doesn't want some man to come by and touch her feet. Like her real feet with toes, okay? That's not what's going on there. This is euphemistic language, again, for the sexual, you know, genital area. You get the same thing with Ruth 3 and 4. Again, Naomi tells Ruth, you know, when Boaz lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. This is when Ruth wants to, and she gets the message across pretty well. She uncovers his genital area. I mean, they're wearing these long skirt things. She just flips it open. They don't have underwear, folks, in the Bible days, okay? That'll probably become a meme now. They don't have underwear. So she exposes him. Why does she expose him? Why does Ruth do this to Boaz? It's a marriage proposal. I want you to marry me. I want to have your children. You need to redeem me. You know, we're related. It's the law of the kinsman redeemer. You know, she wants him to take her in, you know, and become his wife. And then we get the whole thing about, well, there's somebody that's in line ahead of me and, you know, got to take care of that kinsman thing according to the laws of Deuteronomy, blah, 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 blah. I mean, there's nothing sexual, you know, as far as intercourse that happens in the Ruth scene, because that would have been a violation of the kinsman law. And Boaz doesn't do that. They go through the legal procedure before he can marry her. But she makes her intent, her wish, very obvious. She exposes him and then lays down. And it's like, okay, message understood. They have the conversation about what to do next. But again, the whole point is here, the reference to the feet is the genital area. Now, Durham, again, notes this. This isn't just Mike, you know, going to crazy town here. This is common, you know, Old Testament scholarship. This is nothing new. You'd find this in serious commentaries. Written by various people. Again, Durham thinks this makes good, again, contextual sense as far as Exodus chapter 4, verses 24 through 26, when, put it this way, the act of touching the foreskin of Moses' son, okay, Zipporah performs the circumcision, takes the foreskin and touches Moses' feet. The act of touching the foreskin to the feet, i.e. Moses' own genital area, the touching part is not part of normal circumcision. You don't read that as part of a procedure for circumcision. So there's some special circumstance. And of course, the circumstance is that Moses' own circumcision is not adequate. He has to be approved. He has to be sort of looped into the covenant relationship by proxy. He has to have this taken care of, like now, and then get to Egypt, like now. So it consequently only makes sense if Zipporah has circumcised her son, Gershom, and then symbolically transferred the circumcision to Moses by taking the foreskin and touching Moses' genitals with it. Under the circumstances, Moses would have been incapacitated had they done this to him, had they circumcised him, and they were already on the way to Egypt. So apparently, if you read again through verse 26, God was satisfied by the ritual act, and Zipporah had saved her husband's life. I mean, that's what's going on here. In regard to the phrase bridegroom of blood, the phrase is obviously associated with the marital relationship. Okay, the word bridegroom there. So why use the term and what's the bridegroom of blood? I mean, what's the significance of the phrase? Moses' status as a bridegroom must, of course, have some importance here. And Durham, I'll just read from Durham here. Durham says, Zipporah, the only person available to perform the rite, and again, I agree with that because I don't think they've met Aaron yet, seizes the mandatory flint cutting tool, and circumcises not Moses, who would have been temporarily incapacitated by the surgery, at a crucial time when he could no longer delay his journey. So she circumcises her son. For the child, who was not to make the journey to Egypt in any case, the effects of the circumcision would be less problematic. To transfer the effect of the rite, Zipporah touched the severed foreskin of her son to the genitals of Moses, intoning as she did so the ancient formula, recalling circumcision as a premarital rite. For a bridegroom of blood you are to me. This ancient phrase, as Mitchell has demonstrated, it was a phrase of marital relationship. Now, in other words, let me try to decipher some of that. Circumcision was a premarital ritual, obviously performed on a male infant, you know, well before the boy is going to get married. As the sign of the covenant, circumcision identified men as Israelite for the sake of Israelite women, because they were only supposed to marry fellow Israelites. So when you got your man there, it's your honeymoon night, okay, the fact that he's circumcised is important because then you know you're marrying within the covenant bounds. This is why circumcision is, one of its meanings is, again, has to do with marriage, you know, that the marriage is legit. Okay, it's within, again, the Israelite community. So it ensured that the married couple were both Israelites and there was no forbidden intermarriage taking place. We have to assume that Zipporah had learned and embraced the idea that the God of the mountain, she knew by virtue of her proximity to it in Midian anyway, you know, I mean, they had heard of Yahweh and they knew where the mountain was. It's not next door, but they know where it is. That this was the God of the Israelites. Okay, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Moses, or Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he was the true God. So Zipporah apparently knows that, believes it. This is particularly coherent if the Kenite connection involves the worship of Yahweh, which again we talked about at length. Zipporah's marriage to Moses linked her to the Israelite people. Okay, she's marrying Moses now, and their covenant relationship to Yahweh. Under normal circumstances, her husband would have been a circumcised Israelite man, but that apparently isn't what's going on here between the two of them. This ritual of circumcision by proxy made Moses her bridegroom of blood. It legitimized him as an Israelite man that she could marry and be secure in marrying within a covenant relationship with Yahweh. And so part of the ritual act of touching the foreskin of Gershom to Moses' genital area atoned for this oversight. And again, Zipporah saves Moses. And here's the kicker, you know, and we'll end with this, a little bit of a kicker here. Zipporah saves his life. How? By performing a priestly act. That's interesting in and of itself because she's a woman, right? A woman plays the role of a priest in this scene. And God accepts that. And the circumstances are unusual, but there it is. And this is why I think the incident occurred again before Moses linked up with Aaron. Had Aaron been there, he's a Levite, he likely would have done this, you know, and there you go. Now, without getting into the whole, you know, women in ministry issue, which if you're unfamiliar with me or my podcast or the blog, I don't know how many years ago it was, probably 5-6 years ago as well. I went through a blog series with my friend, John Hobbins, who is we met in the doctoral program at Wisconsin. John is a Methodist pastor, and his wife is also a pastor at the same church. So John proposed to me one day, hey, let's you and I blog back and forth about, you know, the women in ministry issue. And I said to him, and we put it in the blog series, I said, okay, your mission here is to make me care. And the reason I said that is because I can argue both sides of this really well. And that alone tells me that, again, if you can argue both sides really well, and ultimately you get down to things like the non-use of accents in capital uncial script in Greek manuscripts. I'm not kidding. It gets that granular, you know, to decide, you know, this whole issue. So to me, this is something that, look, you'd have to be omniscient to know for sure where to land on this. And so to me, this is a conscience issue, which is why I said, just make me care. You know, whatever decision you make it before the Lord, and, you know, whatever it is, do a good job. You know, or not. I mean, this is how I would approach it with my own daughter. If I had a daughter, say, I feel called to the ministry. This is exactly what I would tell her. I don't know that this is, you know, the right decision, but I'm not going to get in your way. It's between you and the Lord, and in the providence of God. If this is what the Lord wants you to do, you know, good, and do a good job. You know, don't screw up. You know, that kind of thing. So, beyond that, it's such a difficult issue. It's so granular. Anybody who tells you that there's nothing to see here and argue about is just wrong. They're just wrong. What things that you think are clear, like 1 Timothy 3, you know, husband of one wife thing, trust me. you take that over the same description to deacons, and guess what? You got a female deacon in 1 Corinthians. Now what do you do with that? Well, that must have been the deacon's wife. Oh, really? Where does it say that? Well, it doesn't, but that's what I think, because I need to think that, because this is the view I want to defend. Exactly. Exactly. So this is where this debate goes. It goes to, again, picking the things that you want to accentuate to defend your view. And I think the best thing to do here is just be honest and say, look, I can argue both sides of this really well. It's amazingly granular at the end of the day. And at the end of the day, we have to guess. And so I'm not going to disfellowship you on the basis of my guessing, even if I think the guessing is good. I'm just not going to do that. Like I like to say, I will let some other ministry fight Christians. I'm not going to do that. Let's circle it back here. I think it's interesting, though. You know, you can't use Exodus 4, 24 through 26 to say egalitarianism, that is, women can be ordained. Okay, egalitarianism is biblical. Look at what Zipporah did. Okay, that's an overuse of the data. The circumstances are really unusual. But on the other side, the complementarian side, which says women cannot be ordained, okay, they should not be in ministry, that side routinely neglects things like this. Okay, where God himself is good with a woman performing a priestly function. It's just there in the text. Now, it doesn't mean that their view is overturned either. You have to be able to say this is a proof of one thing to overturn the other. It becomes a little piece, a little cog, a little, you know, just one of many items in this whole discussion, you know, the women in ministry discussion. So, I mean, you could go look at the website. Hobbins is spelled H-O-B-B-I-N-S. You know, you'll find it if you put drmsh.com and Hobbins and women in ministry or something like that in there. You're going to find our little back and forth. You know, it was fun. I think it was entertaining and useful for some people. But to me, there's built-in ambiguity to the whole issue. It's very difficult. So I think extreme forms of complementarianism ought to at least take note of what's going on here in Exodus, you know, 4, 24 through 26. Zipporah does what she does. It's a priestly role, and God is good with it. But that's about all you can say. You can't really build a view on that or overturn somebody else's view. You know, we have to be honest with the limitations of the data and, just be good with that. So again, I'll let some other ministry beat up Christians on either side, you know, from either side or against either, you know, I'll let them do that. But I'm just not going to do that. There's just more interesting and better things to do with my time. And I think there's better things for you to do with your time than, again, try to take something that's ambiguous and pretend at the end of the day that it's not. Because it is. Be warmed and filled. Pick the view that you prefer. But be honest with the other side and say, I'm here because I prefer this for this, that, and the other reason. But you are still a brother. I am not going to look at you as any lesser because you don't take this particular issue the way I do. Okay, this is the way I approach prophecy. I mean, just any number of things. These things are what they are. I think we should study them. We should try to think well about them. But more important than that, you know, is we should treat each other like not only fellow imagers, but brethren, you know, brothers and sisters in the Lord, even when we come to disagree over things. So again, that was just a little bit of a sidebar. But I think, again, the passage is interesting just as a contributing point to that bigger theological discussion. So we're at the end of Exodus 4 here, and that means next time we will jump into chapter 5.
All right, Mike. Well, we'll take your educated guess over most, so it works for us.
It's what it is. What it is.
We'll take it. And again, my whole deal is it's okay to not know. You don't have to know every single little thing, and that's okay.
You know, I don't know. This is going to be an illustration totally lost on most people, but here's what it makes me think of. If you're listening out there and you've ever seen the movie In Search of Bobby Fischer, there's a scene in there where the guy is taking his son, who's this chess prodigy, to a chess club, you know, to eventually, like, I guess, make him a grandmaster or something like this. And there's this scene where there's this this guy comes up to the instructor. He interrupts a conversation between the instructor and the kid. And he's so excited. He's like trembling with excitement. And he's, I captured a pawn. That was it. It's like it took him weeks, you know, against these fellow, you know, players who are just at this elevated level. Like he got a pawn. Okay. You know, that's what this reminds me of. You know, these sorts of discussions where they're so, again, they're difficult. And to think that you've accomplished something, you know, by capturing the pawn, you really haven't. There's a whole lot more to the game, you know, than just this one pawn. You know, so I always think about that kind of obsession, you know, that obsessiveness that you're so dedicated, you've got to find the answer to this thing. The authorship of the book of Hebrews. That's kind of an academic joke now for people who sort of lose their minds and maybe their careers. You know, they get obsessed with these questions like who wrote the book of Hebrews. And at the end of the day, I'm sorry, but you just can't know. There's no way to know for sure. So take all that energy and that skill and that training and put it into maybe things that you can know better or ministry. You just let it go. Let it be what it is.
I love chess references. My son, last year he was 8, and we entered a chess tournament for the first time ever, and he beat a local high school chess member in 4 moves. So that was a very proud moment for me. I had taught him chess. I love chess. So I taught him to play since he was 5. And I mean, he's not, you know, a grandmaster, don't get me wrong, but hey, to beat a high school kid as an 8-year-old in your first tournament in 4 moves, it was a very proud father moment for me.
I'm sure that did something for his self-esteem too.
Yeah, it was awesome. Bobby Fischer, love those references. There you go.
There you go.
All right, Mike.
Salt at these kinds of obsessions. I always think of that guy.
Do you play chess?
I mean, I know how to play, but I haven't played in years. I'm not a chess player, you know, of any, I can't assign any meaning to that, to the statement that I play chess.
Yeah.
Well, I know how to move the pieces.
Well, we need to play sometime. That'd be fun. All right. Yeah. All right, Mike. Well, we're looking forward to chapter 5 and maybe 6 as well.
We might get in. It just depends. You know, we're going to get into the Pharaoh's hard heart stuff, so that might take us, you know, across a couple chapters, but we'll see.
All right. Sounds good. All right, Mike. Looking forward to it. Just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.